Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm really pleased to see that integrated care is on your agenda. It seems to be top of the policy hit parade at the moment. And I think we could all agree, can we not, that that for many people, integrated care offers three potential prizes, really. It offers people a better experience of joined-up care. If for many people it offers better outcomes, and finally it makes the resources go further. So lots of reasons why integrated care is a good thing, but it does beg the question, does it not, why is it after 63 years it remains a policy aspiration rather than a policy achievement that is in place everywhere? It begs a further question of how am I going to explain this all to you in less than 15 minutes, which is a slightly bigger challenge. And you know, in my darker moments, when thinking about this, I imagine a world or a country which has been devastated by nuclear holocaust. And there's just two things that survive. And the first thing is cockroaches. And the second thing that survives in that some small corner of this landscape, there is a small huddle of people having a seminar about how to integrate health and social care. Actually, there is a third thing that survives, and that's a regional tier of the NHS. But that's another story, and we won't go there because I don't want to depress you this afternoon. I mean, we all know what happens when we don't achieve integrated care, and we get screaming headlines like this. And you know, things are becoming quite difficult, I think, particularly at the interface of health and social care. We've done a number of reports and work in this area. I will give you some links to our website at the end where you can download this stuff. And our work has entered a new phase following the NHS Future Forum in that, along with our fellow think tank, the Nuffield Trust, we are taking the NHS Future Forum at its word when it said we need to move beyond arguing for integration to making it happen. And we're putting together a programme of work that addresses some of these big questions that you can see. And on our website, there is a really good slide pack which summarises all the evidence about integrated care. So I'm not going to go through all that now, but there isn't time. But I do urge, if you've got an interest in this area, I do urge you to have a look at that. The web link will be at the end. And really, it all comes down to what in Torbay they called Mrs. Smith, a fictitious woman in her 80s with a range of long-term health and social care problems for which she needs care and support. And basically, how do we get from this fragmented pieces of the jigsaw, different services, parts of the health service, parts of the social care system, to a coordinated service that meets her need? So focusing it on the individual, I think, and their experience is incredibly helpful. As we point out in our slide pack, I mean, there are lots of forms of integrated care. We talk about horizontal integration between health and social care. We talk about vertical integration within the NHS. We talk about integrated care within one sector or between preventative and curative services. We talk about engaging with providers and patients to support shared decision-making, which is becoming increasingly important. And then there is a population-based approach to it. So, you know, there's lots of ways. And one of the things the evidence tells us is that there is no single panacea, no one best way of doing it. Very much depends on local circumstances. I just want to briefly also acknowledge that it's not just about integration within the NHS. There are some very important interfaces with the wider local government services. I'm going to focus the next few minutes on social care, but I just wanted to flag up there are these other important relationships that need to be developed between the NHS and local authorities, where the current proposals, the first reorganisation of the health service since 1948 that actually strengthens the local government role in the way that I've set out here. And I think in particular of significance is the creation of health and wellbeing boards, which have important new responsibilities to set out health and wellbeing strategies based on joint strategic need assessments that will act as the commissioning framework in which commissioning groups and local authorities commission their care. So it's a very important proposals within the current health and social care bill that impact upon this. And I just wanted to flag up quickly as well that social care is a changing sector. More and more people are arranging their own care. More and more people have personal budgets. This is no longer a kind of a homogenous local authority monopoly. The social care workforce is bigger than the NHS, and we've got 6 million unpaid carers. So it's a very, very different setup. We already have the majority of social care provided by voluntary and private and not-for-profit providers. The idea, the notion of any qualified provider that's so, been so controversial in the health reforms, been there, done it, got the whole wardrobe as far as social care is concerned. So we already have a thriving mixed economy. And the creation of clinical commissioning groups, I think, offers some real opportunities to tackle some of the problems that has been very difficult to address in the past, particularly because of the enhanced role of GPs in commissioning. Certainly in my professional career, GPs were always one of the hardest groups to engage with. And I think there's lots of examples now, particularly through the work on health and wellbeing boards, where GPs, through clinical commissioning groups, are coming together with local authority colleagues and developing new partnerships. And there are lots of ways in which that can produce more integrated solutions. Just want to acknowledge as well, though, that social care resources are under immense pressure. Alongside the Nicholson challenge facing the NHS, we've got social care budgets up and down the country which contain almost £1 billion less this year than they did last year. And although the £1 billion allocation from the NHS budget will really help, it's not enough to keep pace with demography and with the fact that local government settlement, the wider pot of money that local authorities get, really got clobbered in the spending review, thus undoing a lot of the benefits of the extra money the government did put in. So we've got a position now where 82% of local authorities are only meeting substantial and critical needs. So social care resources under real pressure, and that is going to make it much harder. And there's three areas quickly to consider, and this I think is the most important one. What kind of services should be prioritised for investment? There's other ways that the health and social care interface can be developed locally, but I do want to focus on that green box, because we're now beginning to get a good, promising evidence base about the value of things like prevention, of care at home, of telecare, and reablement, in terms of keeping people out of hospital and enabling people to live more independently. So there's a range of services there which should be the subject of joint discussion across health and social care. And I think there are four things that people have got to concentrate on locally, because I think we're in an environment now where the government doesn't issue prescriptive guidance anymore that tells everybody what to do. It's very much about local solutions to local problems. So I think there are four areas. One is about how you manage the pressures. Are the key people in your health and social care system meeting regularly, monitoring, managing these sorts of pressures that bubble up when health and social care resources are under pressure? A key thing is about understanding the needs of your local people. And I mentioned Torbay. I think one of their more impressive achievements has been the way that together they've developed some shared metrics, particularly focusing on frail elderly, about who uses what kinds of services. And that enables them to look at how well they're performing, look at things like emergency hospital admission rates and admissions to residential care, and focusing resources on people who are at risk of admission, and using that to guide the way they spend their money. And a third crucial area is local partners working together to get the resources around, aligned with the needs of people at different points in their care pathway. And there's lots of ways that you can do that, through pool budget, through place-based or community budgets is the latest incarnation of that, or through integrated commissioning. And finally, there's this wider role of local government in terms of promoting health. And the notion of active ageing and the health improvement work that local authorities and public health colleagues do to keep people out of formal care system and hospitals in the first place. And that's going to be absolutely imperative. I just wanted to say a quick scan of how the NHS reforms the Health and Social Care Bill will make it easier and at the same time more difficult. I think it's good that GPs are in the driving seat of commissioning. They know their patients. That will be a good source of experience. I think the emphasis on integrated care will be a good thing. Nobody is arguing about health and wellbeing boards. That's one aspect of the bill which everybody seems to be supporting. It's the one place in this new architecture that brings people together. So that's a positive opportunity there. Question marks about how it will work with the National Commissioning Board and the balance of power. A downside, structures of the health service are much more complex now. And in terms of joining things up, complexity is a bad thing. You want things to be simple. So the new structures are more complex, more difficult to understand. A lot of organisational change, key people moving on, disturbing the chemistry, the development of trust that we know is vital for good partnerships between health and social care bodies to develop. And the biggest challenge in all of this is not the reorganisation and reform, but it's focusing on this £20 billion productivity gap that the NHS faces over the next 4 years. And alongside those social care budget pressures, that will place both systems under massive pressure. $64 question is, will it be so bad that it forces people to collaborate and share resources, or will it just produce conflict, cost shunting, disputes, and argument? And I suspect the answer to that depends on it depends where you are and the history of past working relationships. The final thing I want to point out is about this crucial point about leadership. We had a big commission, independent commission, looking at leadership in the NHS last year, and one of its key recommendations was that leadership is not about just what happens within organisations, it's about how it stretches across NHS boundaries into social care, local government, voluntary sector and other agencies. So no more heroes. We actually want shared leadership, and that's one of the keys to making partnership work. I think I'm probably just about up against my time. I've rattled through this rather quickly, but I do urge you to look at some of those links and pull down some much more detailed information about what I've been talking about. So I hope that has been helpful to you. Back to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.